You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at WPCouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Okay, so as I was telling you a little while ago, what we try to do here is bring new ideas to you. And you've often heard when we talk about this segment for the council that we are a bottoms-up organization that tries to include everybody. And in the very beginning, there was a distrust. Mistrust would be an understatement of what people felt when it came time to give Uncle Sam information about anything, particularly about where you're catching your fish and how many of them you're catching. But that's been changing over a while. And we have a great show today based on something that's going on that includes a whole bunch of the people and includes maybe, it's hopefully not too late, a whole bunch of indigenous input. And we're gonna introduce you to some really cool people in a minute. But I want to first start with Charlie, my friend Charlie Kaiai, who you might remember. We did this big schmaltzy retirement goodbye aloha thing a couple of years ago. But I knew that he would be back. And it would only be a matter of time. And by golly, I was right. Charlie Kaiai, good morning, my brother.
Yeah, good morning, Mike.
Nice to see you again. You know, I always sort of earmarked it when people ask me about you, and I always was under the understanding that in their infinite wisdom, you were invited to participate in this council thing because they knew that you were a good person who stepped in between and stepped on both pieces of property all the time. In other words, you had a good connection to the indigenous community, and you also knew about business and stuff like that. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm retired, so mostly I'm taking advantage of the time I got to travel. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I traveled around a little bit, Spain, Florida.
I remember I saw something. But, you know, the interesting thing is when you're retiring, you still got your health. You start saying, okay, wait a minute.
Yeah.
there's more I can do. Yeah. So I think that, you know, first of all, was my original statement right? When you started in this, until they got to know you a little bit, were they, I mean, you know, you're Hawaiian, so you can walk up to anybody, but yet it wasn't that easy, right? A lot of these people, particularly in villages or in valleys or on the beach, they didn't want to give, either they didn't want to talk to us at all.
Yeah, I'm 69 now, Mike, so I remember when I was a kid, being Hawaiian was not a good thing.
Yeah, right?
And then you had to kind I'm of not grow too, out of that, right?
I'm in front of you on that one, yeah.
Because most of the Hawaiians, their middle name is Hawaiian, right?
Yeah, yeah.
My last name is Hawaiian. You can't escape it.
Yeah.
So, but it's changed over that 50 years or so that I've been working in this area.
Do you think that some of the change was fostered by some of the administrators of a lot of these areas that you've been saying, hey, wait a minute, these people have a lot of knowledge. If all we have to do is get them to share it and not be afraid of sharing it.
Yeah, and there's a couple of mounds, hills that you have to get over to that, because I think that when Native people share information, people take it and run with it, right? And we don't benefit from it. So that's always been an important part of what I do. Is to look at that indigenous information. Now people taking it and they're getting they're doing their master's programs on something they learned from Auntie down in Kau or something, and that always bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
But it also was that we needed to get in front of these people and tell them what we knew. And you got to be aggressive about it, right?
I liked about it is you figured out a way to thank them in advance.
Yeah.
You know, you walk into a place and say, look, we really need this from you. You know, we don't want to make decisions that are going to affect your life if you don't have something to say about it.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Now, part of that is some of you may have, as you travel around the state, you've seen an increased presence, if you will, of fish ponds and other things that were sort of lost. And you had to go to Molokai to really see one. And, you know, everybody knows about what happens out here at Heia on the island of Oahu. There's a group called Kua. Brenda Sunson is part of that group, and she goes around, I guess, on your hands and knees, moving rocks and making ponds bigger. Right? What is Kua?
Kua, we're a nonprofit, and we facilitate community networks. So I'm just lucky to work with the network of fish ponds and fish pond practitioners, and really, I'm lucky to be here because of folks like Charlie who have done work for many decades.
But you know what? You're kind of a youngster in the group, and I'm going to tell you that growing up as a kid, I remember when they were working fish ponds, and then they went away, and now they're back. So this must mean a lot. And what I see when I see these projects, and you can address that, is I see a lot of young people that are willing to roll up their sleeves and pick up rocks and do what they're told. Mm-hmm. Because thank goodness you folks have been able to collect people who can remember the way it should be.
Yeah. We're really lucky that folks like you are still around and folks who remember how the fish ponds were operated, because we're kind of trying to put that all back together again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember people used to say, wait a minute, the fish go in, but they don't go out. How come? Well, because they're happy in there.
Yeah.
And then we watch them grow and then we eat them. Mm-hmm, you know, it's fair enough. Okay, now, when every now and again we get an opportunity to meet somebody new, and that's our other member of our group today, and right away you're going to see he says a boot and stuff like that. So you can know he's like Canadian around the edges, but he's one of us. His name is Peter Romer. And working in the indigenous community, because he is one. I've been a commercial fisherman for years and years, and we really are lucky that you're attending this meeting, Peter, because you bring a group of information that we just don't have. You grew up in the fishery as a fisherman.
I did. I was born on a boat.
Kind of boat?
6 months old, on a troller, 42-foot troller, wooden troller. It was painted orange, and her name was Serenade.
Isn't that nice? And this was the family?
This was a family business, yes, through my father.
So you were on that boat from how old were you?
Since 6 months old till I was about 19.
And how did you get educated along the way besides how to be a fisherman?
Well, after the fishing was starting to collapse, I got funded by through the Fishermen's Union to go into film school.
Yeah, but that's not automatic. You had to be able. You had to show some degree of ability or interest or promise. Did you have to make a commitment? Okay, I'll do that. But, you know.
It had to be done in a year, and you had to get a job out of it right away to get the funding. Yeah.
Okay, now when you say funding, what's the funding for?
Well, they were doing these makeshift work programs for recovering fishermen who were after the fishing collapse in the mid-90s. And
Did we get a signal that it was collapsing that was ignored?
Oh, we got many signals. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so that this audience, which is mainly in Hawaii and part of the Pacific, that listens to us online, what geographic location are we talking about here with you?
We're talking about the Pacific Ocean, the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
Pretty much a Canadian ground.
Canadian fishing grounds, where all the big salmon come from. Mm-hmm. We are salmon fishermen, all types of salmon, and at the end of the year we do some cod fishing.
Everybody thinks salmon's inexhaustible, is it?
It's totally been disappearing very quickly. Yeah.
Is it alarming?
It's alarming. Absolutely.
What steps are being taken to not just recognize it, but try to mitigate and return it?
There's been different fishery programs, different hatchery programs of trying to seed more salmon. But the rivers have all been kind of under attack from the early 80s, you know, from overfishing, overlogging straight to the rivers. So the erosion, they just left the logs blocking the whole way.
Yeah, in other words, just walk away, right? And now here's the problem.
And then the laws came afterwards after the damage was done.
You know, I think, but what's kind of interesting to me, Charlie, is that here he's talking about, like, it's easy to talk about rivers. We're hard-pressed to find rivers here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we got these things we call rivers, rivers, but they're certainly not really rivers, are they?
Yeah, no, they're not. Yeah. They're streams.
So what does it mean to you, you know, to be part of this deal, and also to Brenda, the same thing, to be Hawaiian and to be having to learn this new side of things and then realize, hey, wait a minute, we're kind of like these guys. We have similar problems.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is an interesting kind of group that we have here. I think if we are indigenous nations, then do we have agreements with each other?
Mm-hmm.
And do those
who's going to enforce them, right?
Yeah, yeah. And do those agreements cross border lines?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do we have an agreement with Canada, with the Canadian nations, that would cross that Canadian-American border, right? And that's a good question. I think that's a question that we can examine. This gives us an opportunity to talk about that, right? Even the U.S., we're going to have Makah from Washington coming in, right? Makah has a cultural thousand-year association with
Canadian natives. I saw one of the guys, and he looks like a throwback. I mean, it's his dress, his, you know, everything. And I mean, that as a compliment. I mean, what we're talking about is so much history and so much tradition, you know?
And they share those histories. Yeah. They share those traditions. Yeah. Now, can we do a cross-border thing? Can we have a negotiation between Macaw and, say, the Inuit in Canada that would be able to cross that U.S.-Canada border, right?
Yeah.
Is that going to be something that's recognized?
Yeah, that's a really good question. This actually came up. Many of you know that I worked in Alaska for a while, and I did a fishing and outdoors television show. And one of the things that we learned is, and Charlie said this to me a million times, is the fish, unfortunately, don't know whose grounds they're in. You know, they don't know if they've left, you know, your clan's grounds and gone to my clan. They're just eating. They're going to go wherever the food is. And I'm thinking, in the Northwest, Peter, are there exceptions, territorial exceptions for a fisherman, or are they sometimes geographically very restricted? Or is it both?
It's a little bit of both. It's pretty complicated. You know, we have two really big rivers. We have four, really. We got the Fraser River. So
just to give people an idea, I mean, how far across is the Fraser? When it hits the ocean, how far across is it?
Oh, geez, I don't know the numbers on that.
I mean, just ballpark. It's a long ways.
It's a massive river. It's it goes all the way up through the province of British Columbia, halfway through the province of British Columbia.
So, I mean, you know what we call rivers here, right? They're little streams over here that don't go anywhere.
Yeah, we just had a massive rock slide, actually, that's been, we were something about 6 million were supposed to come back, and something like, don't quote me on these numbers, but about, like, just say about 600,000 only came back.
In other words, Mother Nature, or whoever, caused a major change in the way these fish can spawn. They just couldn't get up there?
They can't get, so actually they're helicoptering a lot of these salmon into the other side of this rock slide because there's no roads to this area. It's really devastating, but we have the Stikine, the Nass, and the Skeena River in northern British Columbia, and they all come from the Sacred Headwaters. Mm-hmm. They go around, all around the Haida Gwaii, all around Vancouver Island, down up, some up to Fraser's, or they'll return back.
Lots and lots of nautical miles we're talking about here.
And they feed all the communities, they feed all the industry, all the fisheries, you know. So it's a very fine balance with it. But, you know, it depends what type of fish you're talking about, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the sockeye is the sought-after fish.
Sure.
You know, the coho is really in trouble. No one has, hardly anyone sees coho anymore. You know, in the old days, we used to have, our decks were full of fish, you know, and hard to get 30 fish on a deck if you're trolling. You know, it's really been depleted, you know.
Just out of curiosity, because, you know, when we talk here, we talk to our longline fleet, we talk to our overnight guys, we talk to our day fishers. The type of fishing you were doing, multiple days, were you on the water a long time?
We'd be about 4 months into season, mm-hmm. you know, from the late spring to fall is our fishing period. That's been chiseled down to sometimes only a month now. And
what did they do before the availability of ice and the widespread availability of it? I mean, obviously their trips had to be a lot shorter, but also wasn't some of the water and some of the things cold enough so that ice was an issue, but it wasn't the end of the world?
Not in British Columbia so much. Mm-hmm. We never had to deal with that. But do you mean like for the pack ice?
Yeah, as far as you know.
Well, I mean, as the fishing collapsed, so did all the fish camps. Mm-hmm. You had to go farther. So you had to go back to Vancouver. So you had to get a freezer. You couldn't just pack with your fish with ice anymore. So that changed the industry quite a bit. Became bigger boats, and you know, they would be out there much longer fishing. And then they have freezers, mm-hmm. and then they would sell their fish in Vancouver.
You know, me and Charlie and Brenda were nodding, but we have no idea what that's like. Yeah. But we go out, we have put ice a little bit, come in, give somebody else the fish, and away it goes. Right?
Yeah.
But I still think, and this is why I thought that I was so pleased when I talked to Sylvia Spaulding at the council about getting together and doing a couple of programs on your specific part of this conference that's going on, this Ocean Ops. But it seems that even though it is just a part of it, Charlie, in the big picture, what is the information that's going to be shared here is pretty important.
Yeah, I think it is ocean observation. They get together once every 10 years. They network for between each other, the academics and the scientists. That's great for basic research, but how does it apply?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I think the indigenous delegates can bring in a process that we can apply these things that we're learning over this past 30 years about the ocean and benefit the rest of the entire world community.
One thing that I'd heard, and I don't know, and we'll ask Peter about this as well, is I do know that there was sometimes resentment in the indigenous communities because they do this stuff. They bare their soul, and they give up their information, and nothing would happen.
Wait a minute.
What didn't we fix this last year? How come this isn't fixed?
Yeah. I think one of the things that we gotta examine and we haven't looked at really deeply is that indigenous culture may have ways of managing resources that would benefit the resource and benefit everyone. That
wait a minute. You told me one time, and this is very important, everybody. There were such rules in some of these areas, especially if you were, say, in a large Hawaiian community living in a valley with no need to go somewhere else. You know, you had your ahapua, you had your food, you had your upmauka guides, you had your water guides. Yeah. Everybody was fine. So if you bent or broke the rules, there was price to pay.
Capital punishment. Yeah, in those days.
That's a nice way to put it. Capital punishment, indeed. Yeah.
But the world's changing.
Yeah.
The way we treat, I think one of the things that in this state is that we don't see resources as being as important as I think they should be.
That's really key. Yeah. That's why I'm glad to be able to do this a little bit.
Yeah. So a guy lays an illegal net, he gets a $100 fine.
Yeah.
What is that? He just pulled out $300, $400.
Chump change, right?
Yeah. Chump change. So
it's like the guys that are having the illegal rentals or illegal weddings on the beach.
Yeah.
They charge $1,500. They got to pay a $300 fine, no problem.
Yeah.
They'll just see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So, you know, there's got to be rules. There's got to be a way to make those make the population compliant to those rules. I believe in voluntary compliance. I think that if we go into this ocean observation thing and we look at information that's available, that if the information is compelling, then we'll get voluntary compliance. Mm-hmm. And that reduces the amount that we have to spend on enforcement.
Yeah, and that is a foundational building block, because I can tell you right now, and this is not just in the world of fishing. As you know, on our regular show, we do this a lot. There are plenty of laws on the books. There's laws everywhere, but there's not always enforcement. So,
right.
You know, the law doesn't mean anything unless it gets enforced.
Well, it's got to make sense, right?
One of the things, though, I think is really cool, when we get back talking once again to Peter Romer about this, and that is that, you know, we are kind of in this huge, big piece of the Pacific, right? We're isolated. We're right in the middle of it all. But I'm still interested in noticing the similarities and the differences. I said a while ago that a fish doesn't know if he's in your reef or in the next guy's reef. But what about the native practitioners or the indigenous fishers that have been fishing one way for a long time and then can't go to a certain area anymore? How often does that happen based on trying to replenish stock or regrow a fishery?
Well, each environment is a little complicated in how each indigenous, you know, manages their resources and, you know, sustains it. You know, I just wanted to add on, you know, in British Columbia, we have something called the Coastal Guardianship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a number of nations that all have the guardians. And the guardians work closely for monitoring the oceans.
Yep.
They all have different boats, so they will go out and they will make sure if someone's illegally fishing, they'll notify Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Perfect. Yeah.
And
so I mean, you know what?
There's a relationship that's starting to build.
But let me make sure, just so I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to tell you that this is maybe not voluntary compliance, but compliance because you don't want to get caught. Once the word gets out that there's these people around, are you more or less likely to try and beat the system? You might as well just conform because you're going to get caught if you don't. Is that a fear? I mean, in other words, are there still people that don't care? They'll still take a risk?
You know, you get sport fishermen overfishing and stuff. You know, everything's regulated. It's pretty good, the regulation of how it's coming to, like, poaching fish. It's not as often as you think it is, maybe because we've come a long way in regards to that. You know, the guardians are the eyes and ears on the ocean, and so they're really keeping an eye on everything, and you know, more and more people understand how what dire straits the salmon are in.
Is that group voluntary? Are they compensated? Are they the guardians? Are they employees?
The guardians get certain types of government funding to build their capacities, and
sure.
It starts small and then it builds bigger. They're all hired. A lot of them all have like four different jobs and sure, stuff. Yeah. But they're all
like Hawaii. We know how that is. Yeah.
They're all certified in rescue, marine rescue, mm-hmm. and land rescue. RCM SAR. They have different. Yeah. So they have all the certificates and everything, and they work closely with the Coast Guard as well, doing training every day. And such One Nation Hartley Bay, who actually is building an ocean observatory, they're really advanced when it comes to this kind of thing. So they have the tickets. They can actually they can't arrest anybody, but they can certainly
cite you.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, incidentally, and I think this is sort of interesting because we think that we are dealing with a lot of loose ends and pieces and parts in our world. But it seems to me that there are so many more. When you talk about indigenous people, these are separate indigenous people, right? They're a member of different groups and different clans and different tribes. They don't necessarily all agree with each other and everything.
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, yeah. We have overlapping territories and stuff, and mm-hmm. we have a number of different nations that have treaties. They're in treaty talks. Mm-hmm. Some already have treaties. I'm Niska from people from the Nass River. We have.
Wait a minute, you're what?
I'm Niska.
N-I-S-K-A?
N-I-S-G-A apostrophe A.
Okay. Simple, just so like Hawaii. That's right.
It means the people of the Nass River, which is one of our greatest salmon-bearing rivers.
Oh, okay.
And we actually have a fish wheel for sustainable harvest. So mm-hmm. we just only choose the males and let the females go. Mm-hmm. And it's a state-of-the-art fish wheel.
I should say.
Yeah. Based on old technology, actually, mm-hmm. old science. And but these different nations, we have a different alliances that are starting in British Columbia, and they're working together to keep the communication going, because everybody knows, like, if you don't have the salmon, that salmon's connected to our culture,
sure.
and you start to lose a huge chunk of your culture. Like, everything, it has to do with the ocean and the salmon for our West Coast culture.
You know, maybe you can do this. I know that a lot of people, and as you know, we have a great number of us go to Alaska and go fishing, and everybody wants to go catch salmon and bring their coolers home with their salmon in it. And what really kills them when they get up the rivers is to see all of these hundreds and hundreds and thousands of dying fish. They don't get it. You want to think, they go up there, they should dig in the sand, put their eggs, and then go back out to sea, come back again. They just do this once. What scientific reason? Why did they die? Did they just get all beat up trying to get up there to do their eggs?
It's just the natural cycle, you know. They their teeth get larger, yeah. their heads get bigger. They get ready to fight their way up to compete for their traditional grounds,
yeah.
you know, and to lay their eggs and stuff,
and to evade the bears.
Yeah, they'll try, the bears are all there happily eating away, which helps feed the forest and stuff.
Sure.
So it's all connected. Salmon's so important, plays such a vital role in the ecosystems in the biodiversity of our river systems. If you don't have the salmon, you're not feeding the nutrients into the forest, and it's all connected. The bears are going to get skinny, and then they're going to go into towns and stuff, and they're not happy.
Eat
bears
garbage,
anymore.
Yeah.
So it's all really connected to that, and of course our indigenous culture. But right now they're under attack. The rivers are warming. They're drying up with climate change. In the Alaska, there's a whole bunch of rivers where there's photographs of just all these salmon, like hundreds and hundreds of salmon, just gone to waste. They couldn't make it to
couldn't
to
get
spawn,
up, yeah, yeah.
And the river dried up, and this is happening all over the place. Right
we
now.
Had a guy on. See if you know this guy. We had this guy on a couple of weeks ago. That's got this tube, and it's a tube that operates like a foil on a surfboard, and the salmon, they swim into the tube and they get helped up and shot into the next level over a big fall. And it seems like, where was I when they passed out the brains on this thing? Because I didn't understand it, but now I do. It's said that if people adopt this equipment, that it'll save the fishery. Are you know what I'm talking about, this tube thing?
Yeah, I've seen it once.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends, I think, on the geography of these places. Yeah. Maybe we need that right now on the Fraser River, where this rock slide is. But
yeah, really, no kidding. I think, and I'm I hope you all out there are learning a lot. Peter Romer is a pool of information about a whole different fishery. And I was just sort of smiling because also Brenda Sunchin is here from Kua and Charlie Ka'ai'ai, and he's always been involved with the council as a liaison, if you will, or go-between between the lawmakers and the indigenous folks. And Brenda, you guys are indigenous, right? And isn't it sort of neat that, I don't imagine that we could even conceive of what these other folks in other parts of the world have to go through to get their fish.
Yeah. You know, I can't stop thinking about this. You said a few minutes ago how folks maybe have different ideas or can't agree on things, but so many things that Peter is saying, like, really are familiar and kind of reflect familiar values or practices that can be found in fish ponds here. Yeah. Like, he's talking about the importance of rivers, and that totally is true for fish ponds to be able to thrive. And then he's talking about the relationship to fish and how the importance of fish being there perpetuates, like, the culture that is related to the fish.
Yeah, by the way, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people think fish pond, they just put rocks and it happens. Mm. No, it was somebody said, some kupuna said, that's where the rocks got to go.
Yeah. Really, fish ponds are, like, kind of the way that good farmers say that they're raising good soil. Yeah, actually, fish ponds really are just about making a really good, yummy environment that the fish want to be in. And, like, even this idea that bears eating the salmon feed the forest, it's kind of the same. We're looking for really productive water.
But do you get asked that question? How come they don't swim out once they come in?
Well, like you said earlier, they're too big.
Yeah.
But then also, I mean, fish ponds are ways of keeping predators out. Mm-hmm,
sure.
So, like, they were protected from predation and probably just, like, an abundance of food. So they were good places for them to grow big.
I did hear, and I was talking to some people at Hay a couple of years back, that getting the stock in there is the hardest part. Rebuilding them and repurposing them, no problem. But it's not as though there's no problem, because don't you spend a lot of time just cleaning mangrove and cleaning out getting these ponds back to usable?
Yeah. So it's been interesting, because I think in the past, maybe 5 to 10 years, folks have been really focusing on the physical restoration of those places. And now that they actually have enclosed ponds, folks are looking at, like, well, is the wild stock there to be able to bring in the baby pua that used to feed these places?
Yeah, pretty interesting. Charlie, I guess once again, you know, in that when you take a look at this, this meeting, it starts to make more sense. This indigenous faction of it is going to be exploited or used.
I think there's a lot of commonality between indigenous people around the world. One of the things I think that we can learn is that the best management of resources is adaptive, and we've adapted for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So I think those are some of the things that we can look at.
Do you remember once a couple of years ago we talked about the tide calendar?
Yeah.
And nice tide calendar, nice pictures and everything else. But you got to go, to the boss on the beach, and he'll say, you know what, take that and throw it out. But that's not how it works where we are. Yeah. It works totally differently. And mullet season here is not the same as mullet season where you are.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And one of the things about fish ponds, I think, from my understanding, is that they were all self-recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
So the fish ponds were built where naturally fish aggregated. And that's going to have a freshwater source, because that freshwater source makes that ocean more fertile.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part about it. And when I could see you nodding, Brenda, when Peter was talking about things that have to go into the forest, you may think you're losing fish, but you're gaining, because it's making the forest work, and the forest is gonna, I guess, supplement the fish. Interesting. Yeah. I think, you know, we have so much to talk about on this that we're going to have our same guest back next week. But before that, Peter, let's go over what you expect. I mean, some of you have traveled, and talk about how many of you are going to, you know, here for this. Traveled a great distance. Let's talk about goals and aspirations. What do you want your parting gifts to be? What do you want to take away from this?
Well, we're going to talk about all these, you know, all these different ideas. But the one thing I want to add about it is that the understanding of the power of data, of our own indigenous people building their own data. So at Ocean Networks Canada, we create and connect all those things. So we see things with nations from what their needs are. Instead of coming in dictating what we want for scientific purposes, they tell us what they need for scientific purposes. So we create partnerships, meaningful partnerships. Yeah. And I can't stress it anymore. So the power of data helps, you know, to ensure that we can help protect all these resources.
How is technology helping in that? In that, you know, we're starting to see more and more people here computerized. It used to be your fish catch reports were handwritten with carbon paper in between, and now it's maybe the fisherman doesn't know how to do it, but his grandson does. You know, we're embracing technology. You too?
Yeah, well, the technology that we're talking about here at Ocean Networks Canada and stuff, and what's going to be at this Ocean OBS, is that we have all kinds of sensors, from noise pollution to protecting whales, to monitoring shipping, to understanding acidification. You know, we have the technology. We have real-time data coming out, cabled observatories connected to the internet that people can, citizen science could come in and take a look at themselves in real time. Yeah. But that's real data that Indigenous people can use for their own initiatives, and we can all gather together and create one very powerful unit of understand each other's data and where the ocean is right now and how we can help protect it.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And before we end this day's meeting, Charlie, let's talk about, in the last couple of weeks, we've had whales beaching. And, you know, every time that happens, people say, well, why did this happen? And there's a lot of, you know, activists who want to just say, well, it's the Navy testing the machines. And yet somebody will tell you scientifically that, wait a minute, this has been happening for a long time. It may be affected by that, but that can't be the sole cause, because we have, you know, historical data of this happening before there was a submarine.
Right, right. And let's go with Peter. Let's collect the data.
Yeah.
And then do the analysis, right? Let's not guess at what's happening, and then let's not guess at what's happening and then trying to fit our data into what's happening. So let's collect the data.
Yeah.
Let's understand what's going on. Yeah. Let's make some analysis, and maybe we can get some progress.
Well, you can remember before, when you take a look at stats or data or input, you just push the numbers to make it say whatever you're supposed to say, so you can go about and do your other thing. Right?
Yeah, that's that modeling stuff that's going on. But it's okay. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the scientific things that you can do. I mean, the Bayesian, I love the Bayesian model they got now. It gives you the most likely possibility.
Yeah.
Is there anything more Weasley than that?
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like when you take a look at the tracking of a hurricane and you see all the different ideas. Well, which is the one that I got to bury my head on, right?
Yeah.
Well, listen, I knew that we were not going to be able to do this all in one piece. So let's all take a couple days off and come back again.
Can I mention one thing, Mike?
Yeah, you may.
Okay. They're going to stream some of this on YouTube, some of the Ocean OBS, and if you have access to it, maybe you want to watch it. I think it could satisfy your interest in seeing what the world is doing, what the globe is doing on ocean observation.
Yeah, and that's great. And that's good. Just Google. Just go to YouTube and go Ocean OBS. You'd be amazed at what's out there. And by the way, if you want to hear something on a future show, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. See you next week. Aloha.